Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Edward Snowden is a useful idiot. So says a new book on the NSA leaker that charges him with betraying the democratic West and being a patsy for Vladimir Putin. Also, where do the Elgin marbles belong? Why the Loveys are wrong yet again. I'm joined in the studio by Edward Lucas, who writes for The Economist, and by The Telegraph's Harry Mount. As the Sochi Games play, the world's eyes are on Russia, a country under the rule of a former KGB chief that yearns for a return to the Soviet peak of world influence. Recently, the Kremlin scored a propaganda coup when Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker, took refuge in Moscow. His supporters credited Snowden with exposing the true extent of America's security state. But some people think he served a different purpose. Edward Lucas, a former Moscow bureau chief for The Economist, wrote for The Telegraph that, quote, "The damage done by Snowden's revelations neatly and suspiciously fits the interests of one country, Russia." In his new e-book, The Snowden Operation Inside the West's Greatest Intelligence Disaster, Edward Lucas suggests that Snowden has done enormous damage to Western interests, misrepresented its intelligence agencies, and helped to create the entirely false impression that Putin represents a benign resistance to American imperialism. Edward Snowden, consciously or unconsciously, is a Kremlin stooge. Earlier today, I interviewed Edward Lucas and I began by asking him how Snowden's spying has worked to Vladimir Putin's advantage.
The revelations have divided the West among itself. They've sowed distrust between Europe and America. They've also sowed distrust within Western countries about what the intelligence agencies are doing, quite wrongly in my view, and overlooking the fact that these agencies actually operate under strict legal and constitutional controls, in America's case, the strictest system of supervision and scrutiny in the world. They've also weakened the West's attempt to fight off Russian and Chinese attempts to gain control of the internet and impose national control on the internet. And lastly, they've paralyzed our intelligence agencies, which are now very preoccupied with an enormous damage control exercise, trying to work out exactly what Snowden stole and where it may have ended up and what the effects will be.
Okay, so Edward Snowden, I suspect, wouldn't disagree with any of that. He would just say that he's quite proud of having done it. Why worry about the US's standing in the world if it's spying on its allies? Why worry about the unity of the West when it's a lie and the US, without people knowing, is listening in on what its allies are talking about? If America can happily bug Angela Merkel's phone, why on earth would you want to protect that kind of Western unity?
The alternative is much worse. And if you don't like the West, then wait and see how much you'll enjoy a world that's run by the Chinese and the Russians. And I think it's extraordinary that the Snowdenistas, as I call them in my book, are so paranoid about their own governments, which are, to my mind, and I think by most people's standards, the best governments in the world and run the most democratic and law-governed countries that there are. And they're so trusting about countries like Russia, where Snowden arrived so strangely and lived so secretly. And of course, there's countries spy on each other. There's an enormous amount of naivety and hypocrisy here. Countries have been spying on each other, allies spy on each other. There's a very few countries which have no spy agreements, Britain and America with Canada, New Zealand and Australia, perhaps are the most serious example of that. But of course we're going to spy on Germany. Germany has close relations with China, with Russia, with Iran. It breaks sanctions towards Iran. And there's every reason that we should be spying on Germany. And the Germans, for their part, also spy on other countries. In my previous book, I exposed a joint German-Russian spying operation in Estonia on a NATO ally. So I think there's a kind of rather phony idea that spying is somehow illegal and reprehensible. Yeah, it's a mucky business, but it does go on.
Edward Snowden is an idealist, and I have to put words in his mouth because he's certainly not going to come to Britain to say this. He, I suspect, would say, what is the point of us resisting Chinese or Russian hegemony if in order to do that, we end up doing things that turn us into a mirror image of them? If we end up gathering data on our own citizens, if we end up spying on our friends, if we end up, in the case of America, it's possible, actually bending the Constitution, actually lying to Congress in order to make something happen. What is the point of us being the guardians of democracy if we ourselves flaunt it?
I think it's a misapprehension to say that if the West does one thing wrong, then everything in the West is rotten, that democracies are inherently imperfect and they do make mistakes. They tend to be better at correcting them than other countries. But I actually don't think Snowden has exposed any sign of deliberate systematic abuse by the NSA. Everything the NSA does was within the law, and the slides that he's revealed actually, to my mind, and I think in a fair analysis, reveal not a rogue agency, but one that bends over backwards and worries all the time about whether it's breaking the law or not. Does the law allow us to do this? And if not, what do we do? And how do we, is there another way of doing this? And if we turn out we have broken the law accidentally, what do we do? There's a lot of this stuff in the slides.
What, in your opinion, is the nature of the information that he revealed? How important was it?
Well, it comes into several categories. One is about the extent to which the NSA warehouses metadata. This is not the content of communications, but details about them, as it were, the address on the envelope, but not the letter itself. So the direction, duration, location of mobile phone calls. And this data is warehoused by the NSA. It's obtained by court orders entirely legally from the mobile phone companies. And I think on that narrow ground, Snowden did have a claim to be a whistleblower. He could argue that America needed to discuss this and have a better idea of what metadata does to privacy. However, I actually don't think there's any sign of the law being broken. I would personally say, even in that case, it was wrong. But what he's done has gone far beyond that. He's given away details of capabilities that have taken years and tens of billions of dollars to build up and which are exercised against countries which wish us ill in, to my mind, an entirely legitimate and proper way. Why is it in the public interest to reveal how democracies spy on dictatorships? Why is it in the public interest to reveal, for example, that Sweden spies on Russia and how it does it? I think Sweden has every reason to spy on Russia, and it's entirely right that it should do so. And it's astonishing to me that the Snowdenistas, as I call them, the Snowden's fans, don't seem to realise that this is not a complaint about the NSA. This is part of a kind of nihilistic anti-Westernism, which regards everything that the West does as wrong, and anyone who takes part in it as ipso facto guilty.
But it doesn't come from nowhere. I mean, the context of that feeling. And slowly people are starting to draw up biographies of Snowden, which are far more detailed and complex, which I think give the impression of a libertarian who's very much at war with his own government. But that has happened in a context. It's post-Iraq. It's post-Afghanistan. It's post this feeling among many young people, particularly, as we said, technologically savvy people, that the government has gotten too big and is dishonest, and that it required something like this to expose to people exactly how things run. Yes, okay, maybe it was done within the bounds of law, but he wanted people to understand how the American government really works.
He's not shown how the American government really works. He's produced a large number of out-of-context PowerPoint slides where you don't know whether this is something that was proposed, something that was tried and didn't work, something that's still being planned and may happen. It's very difficult to do proper journalism about this sort of secret information, and I think the conclusions that have been drawn from it are frequently quite wrong. And he doesn't, I think, give any weight to the idea that what other countries are doing is genuinely worrying. Why are the Snowdenistas so paranoid about their own countries and so trusting about Russia and China?
Just what are they doing? What do we know they are doing, if we know anything at all?
Well, what we know is that the NSA and GCHQ and other agencies have fantastic capabilities. They can plant malware on people's computers. They can take
I mean the Russians and the Chinese. What do we know about what they're doing?
Well, it would be very nice to have a Russian or Chinese Snowden to tell us some details, and it's astonishing to me that that people aren't asking more questions about this. But we do know that China, for example, engages in very systematic cyber espionage, not only directed at its political opponents, such as the Tibetan government in exile, but also stealing intellectual property of from Western companies and on a wholesale basis, with this intellectual property then being handed over to Chinese companies, which then make competing products. And this is probably the biggest theft of intellectual property in history. And it's happening thanks to state-sponsored espionage in China. Now, before the Snowden operation, we were paying rather a lot of attention to that and, to my mind, beginning to wake up to it. Since then, attention's gone elsewhere.
You use the phrase Snowdenistas to describe people. Two dimensions I want to pick up on with that. First of all, how does Glenn Greenwald fit into all of this? Do you see him as someone who's enabled Edward Snowden and the League?
I think Snowden needed people to get his message across, and there were people who needed a message, who needed a source like Snowden. And as I argue in the book, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that the Russians may have put Snowden in touch with people like Greenwald, because that would produce a very useful alliance from a Russian point of view. Greenwald is an exemplar of what I'm talking about, in that he's got an almost fanatical disregard for America and for its faults. He claims to uphold the Constitution, but he is, I think, far too critical of what America does and doesn't take account of the constraints and the sort of real-world issues that American governments and officials have to deal with. And he's, to my mind, quite blind to the faults of other countries. He's a very eloquent lawyer, rather bombastic, and he's done a very good job in making the Snowden case very punchily, but I think with massive internal contradictions. And just to give you one small example, his outrage when it was revealed that the Swedish government was spying on Gazprom. He said, why should they do that? It's an energy company.
Right.
Not to understand that Gazprom is the energy arm of the Russian government and is suffused with both corruption and with very serious political threats to the countries that it exports to, shows an astonishing naivety in
that. And you actually think there's a possibility that the Russians could have actually put these two men together?
Snowden is just the sort of person that Russian intelligence would notice.
Right.
They like junior, erratic, disillusioned, underappreciated government officials in sensitive positions. And from his online, his very unusual and conspicuous online activities in Geneva, I think he would have certainly come to their attention. And there are, so that he's the sort of person they would have recruited, and he's the sort of person who would have had the secrets that they would want, both in terms of getting them themselves, but also in terms of, from an information warfare perspective, getting them out.
Okay, because my other question in regards to the Snowdenistas, or useful idiots, as you describe them as, is the degree to which you think actually they were used by the Russian secret services?
Well, I think it's rather analogous to CND in the 80s. CND was not run from the Kremlin, but it served the Kremlin's purpose.
Right.
And there were some communists in important positions, and it was communists who kept CND going during the bleak years of the 1970s when no one was interested in this cause. And the idea of the Western peace movement was tremendously useful for Soviet foreign policy in blunting the edge of American attempts to defend Europe. And I see this hysterical campaign for digital privacy based on misapprehensions and exaggerated fears as being very much in the same tradition as the peace movement. And just as the peace movement served the Kremlin then, this campaign is serving it now. I'm not saying...
And the campaign, the contemporary campaign, could in some degree be choreographed.
I think choreographed is too strong, but it reacts to stimuli. And there are things that the Kremlin wants which can... for which this campaign can act as a kind of echo chamber.
Right.
And I think this is exactly what's happening at the moment.
And how exactly has Putin benefited at home?
Well, Putin benefited at home because it allows him to adopt the posture of someone who defends human rights, which
right.
is preposterous given the way that human rights are systematically abused in Russia. He loves to say that the West is hypocritical and abuses human rights just the way that everybody else does. And so, he doesn't claim to be good on human rights. He really just says that the West is bad. And having Snowden living there as a sort of quasi-asylum seeker, quasi-defector, suits him very well.
Finally, with Sochi happening right now, how do you think Putin's status is on the world stage? On the one hand, Russia is a country with a great many problems, a dying population, an economy over-reliant upon natural resources. On the other hand, following Syria and following Snowden, and now with the Olympics, there's a feeling of it actually sort of emerging from the post-Cold War haze as an important power. Do you think that's true, or is it all built upon exactly this kind of subterfuge that you've been describing?
It's very tempting to try and put Russia in one category and say either Russia's getting better or Russia's getting worse. But actually, it's operating on different levels. In the long term, yes, Russia is a declining country with declining population, a clapped-out infrastructure, terrible institutions, and I think history will judge the Putin regime very harshly as having missed an opportunity to modernize. On the other hand, against a background of Western weakness, which is what we have at the moment, there's a great many things that Russia can do, and it's very good at playing mixtures of subterfuge and bluff and saber-rattling, an opportunistic policy, but with something of a grand design behind it to weaken the West. And that's what we're seeing too. And so the Sochi Olympics have been quite a soft power triumph for Russia, because many people said that this is going to be a complete catastrophe, and it hasn't been. It looks quite nice on telly. And the Syria gambit got the West out of a diplomatic trap of its own making. And I think in Ukraine now, we're going to see increasingly the West turning to Russia and saying, please help us sort this out. What they don't necessarily appreciate is this is a mess that Russia has created and that Russia will extract a price for its help in sorting it out.
One final question. Do you think Edward Snowden's future is going to be rather like that of some of the Cambridge Four that made it to Moscow, as someone who sort of becomes part of the security scene in Russia, someone who becomes a sort of symbol for the state, as some of those men did?
I think there's a big difference. That these men, the Cambridge Five, were completely conscious and witting traitors. And I think Snowden probably, in his own mind, believes that he did the right thing and that he's in Russia almost by chance. I actually argue in my book that he was probably bounced into going to Russia because the Russians wanted him to be somewhere where they could control access to him so he didn't blurt out anything embarrassing. But be that as it may, I think it would be difficult and possibly pointless for them to try and actually recruit him as a conscious collaborator. They can just keep him there in a controlled environment, dribble out access to friendly journalists when needed, and meanwhile enjoy all the propaganda benefits they get from having made themselves his hosts.
Edward Lucas, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
George Clooney says that we should hand the Elgin marbles back to Greece. They made them, so they should keep them. By that logic, perhaps the British would like to reclaim the English language back from the Americans. We can finally return all those U's and S's to their rightful place. As a historian, you'd probably expect me to care very strongly about this issue. But actually, I really struggle to have an opinion at all. The only argument I can see for keeping the Elgin marbles is some near-racist assumption that the Greeks wouldn't know how to preserve them. Perhaps we imagine that they'll use them to lay a garden path. Either way, wherever they are, they exist. And, as long as they are well looked after, surely that's all that matters. Harry Mann, however, does feel very strongly that they belong here in Britain. Come on, Harry. Why am I wrong?
Well, I think to begin with, it's perfectly reasonable of George Clooney to say they should be returned. It's a very strong argument. One of the world's, perhaps the world's most influential building, to be reunited with its integral, extremely beautiful 5th century BC sculpture. But it's a knock-on effect argument. If you did allow that to happen, it'd be very hard to make Elgin marbles the one exception to the rule that once a museum has got hold of an object from a different country, it should be held on to by that museum. If you let that principle topple, suddenly every single museum in America would be empty, except for a few paltry examples of American art. Most of British museums would be empty.
Paltry examples of American art.
Well,
as someone who has been to the Smithsonian, I do have to disagree with that.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I love America. I've lived
right
there too. But I mean,
right,
the Met would be largely empty.
Right.
The British Museum would be largely empty. Most museums in Britain, America, the world would be empty, and you would suddenly have incredibly overstuffed museums in France, Greece, Spain, and Italy would have more artifacts than it knew what to deal with. Now, you could put that argument, and that's completely fair enough.
Right.
A logistical nightmare, but I think it's impossible to make an exception just for the Elgin marbles as opposed to the rest of the museum, the contents of the world's museums, which have come from all over the world.
Well, the exception is that in its own place, and again, I want to stress, this is not something I feel very strongly about, but in its own place, it probably makes greater sense. It is an archaeological as well as an artistic thing. It's something which, in the setting of the Parthenon, on that hill, in the museum which is established for it, from which you can see the Parthenon, it might actually not only be better for it in terms of relocating it back to where it came from, but it might also be a better experience for the visitor, for the person looking at it, because it is where it was meant to be.
That's undeniably true. I can't argue that. It would be wonderful.
I mean, but for example, isn't it nicer to see a mosaic on the floor of a Roman villa than it is to see it cut up and stuck on a wall in a museum in
I'm sorry not Britain. To be more controversial, because I completely agree with you. That is true, and it would be wonderful to see the Elgin marbles back on the Parthenon. Not that that would happen. And a secondary argument, this is secondary to the argument I've just made, is that thank God the Elgin marbles were removed by Lord Elgin, because if you compare those that are currently in the British Museum, fantastically crisp, beautiful, incredible sculpture for the 5th century BC or any time, and those that were sadly left on the Parthenon, a lot of them now transplanted into the Acropolis Museum, there's been a terrible erosion of those original marbles. Some of them are still actually on the Parthenon, and those that have been moved down the hill. So he did save them by removing them, but that's the secondary argument to the one I've just put, which is you can't really justify just moving the Elgin marbles
right
back and no other artifacts across the world. I mean, I happen to think they're some of the best artifacts in the world. Other people might say 18th century British country house interiors are pretty wonderful. of which the Met has several examples. Do we rip them out, take them back to British country houses? British country houses themselves have the second greatest collection of Italian art in the world. Do we rip all that out and send it back to Italy?
But are they asking for them? I mean, that's the difference in the case of Greece, that the Greeks actually have made a long-running campaign to get them back, whereas I presume these individual country houses have not made that demand.
No, as far as I know, they haven't asked for it, but I don't see just because they've asked for it, that means they're entitled to it. On a personal show-off note, there is a picture of an ancestor of mine in the Frick collection, Lady Peel, the wife of the Prime Minister. I'd like to have that back, please, but I don't expect to get it back.
right, okay.
I don't think that asking for it makes it any more justified to hand it back.
Right, okay, yeah. Okay. But sometimes in life, it's just nice. It's just nice, especially when Greece has been through all the crap that Greece has been through, not just in the last couple of years, but the last 50 years. Its slow movement to democracy through the rule of the generals and all that sort of thing. Isn't it just nice?
Be very nice, and it's had a very rough time. And as you said in your introduction, the Acropolis Museum is actually a fantastic museum. The stuff that it's got is pretty good, and then it has these sad gaps, which reflect the marbles that are, the vast majority of them that are back here. In London, they would look fantastic there. It would be nice to give it back, but that still doesn't defeat the point that I keep on repeating, is that you can't start a redistribution of the world's art depending on where it came from.
What do you think is the personal psychological motivation for George Clooney making this intervention?
I think if you're looking upon this objectively, as I imagine George Clooney is, it does seem a fair, as you say, nice thing to do. And I don't think there's anything wrong in saying it. There's an extremely good argument for saying it. Christopher Hitchens wrote a very good book saying exactly this, that it should be handed back. It's not an argument that's confined to right or left or stupid or clever. I think it's...
I raise the Clooney point because the one aspect of this debate I do personally feel very passionately about is I'm against the marbles going back, possibly only on the grounds that I hate everyone who thinks they should go back.
Right, well, that's a very good principle. I got a lot of boycotts like that.
I mean, Stephen Fry, generally, whatever his view is on any subject, just point yourself 180 degrees in the opposite direction and run.
Yeah, except early Fry and Laurie, very funny, apart from that downhill.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, obviously that stuff's very, very amusing. But since then, since he's become a celebrity atheist, since he's reinvented himself as the new Oscar Wilde, although he's hardly Benny Hill, but he seems to think he's the new Oscar Wilde, I have noticed that every position he takes, I strongly disagree with. And there does seem to be a big coalition of lovies behind this sort of thing. This does seem to be something that they care about a great deal.
Yes, and although, as I say, it's a perfectly good argument, you will know this, there is a classic argument which normally falls on the left in any argument, which is the argument towards niceness, exactly as you've just put it.
Right.
That if you want to profess your niceness, you're almost always putting forward a left-wing cause, which sounds wonderful, but actually has tremendous difficulties sometimes personally, individually for people, or administratively in this case, or politically and nationally.
Is there any piece of art in this country which you think should go back simply because you don't like it?
I'd love it if Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst took back all their complete cobblers and put it in a vast warehouse somewhere in Somerset or East London, depending on where their studios are.
Well, I think Tracy Emin, one thing I love about her is she said that when she was a teenager, she's depressed and she hated her home life, so she ran away to the bright lights of Margate, which I always think had shown a certain deficit of imagination.
Right, yes, exactly. Actually, there is another point about George Clooney, is he was obviously with Bill Murray promoting a film, The Monuments Men, which is about reclaiming monuments or works of art that had been disgustingly stolen by the Nazis, on the whole from German museums and Jewish collectors. And quite rightly, they returned these works to those German museums and those Jewish collectors. They didn't for a moment say they should return them back to Caravaggio's descendants in Naples or Michelangelo's descendants in Florence. That actually, that does go counter to what he was arguing in that news conference.
Harry Mount, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.